This is Meredith for Real, the Curious Introvert, and I'm Meredith. Here, we explore taboo topics through nuanced conversations. My mission, and yours if you choose to accept it, is to inspire curiosity through exploring the paradox of our world. Each episode is different, so bring your ADD and your earbuds and have a look around. Recently, you shared with me that you want to hear more story-related episodes in the podcast, and this week's episode is quite the story. My guest shares his experience as a teenager being lost at sea for 38 days with his family in the 70s. It's a story that seems just almost too incredible to be true, but as he points out at the end, it's the incredibleness of the situation that gives you the energy to survive. I thought that was such an amazing point. It's a story also with all the best ingredients: killer whales, drinking turtle blood, near death, and life lessons. If you end up liking this episode, you'll also like the one I did with a former meth addict who used to live in the underground tunnels of Las Vegas. That's episode 138. And lastly, check to see if you're following the show on your podcast app. A lot of apps have changed how this works, but you can easily see if you are or not by opening up the show on the app that you're on right now. If you're not following or subscribed, tap that little button so you never miss out on a new episode. All right, friends, keep it curious. Most 16-year-olds are planning their departure to university with visions of late-night co-ed parties and Friday night football. But my next guest had a more unique coming-of-age story. His passage into adulthood included a literal passage with his parents and three siblings on over 14,000 miles aboard a 50-year-old 43-foot schooner yacht, two killer whale attacks, and 38 days lost at sea in a 9-foot dinghy. Today, he's going to share his story and the risk and reward of an adventure as we recount the last voyage of the Lucette, reflective adventurer, mindful mariner, grateful family man, Douglas Robertson. I'm so glad you're here.
Thank you.
So what inspired your family, your parents specifically, to just go off on a sailing adventure?
Okay, we have to wind the clock back quite a bit here, 51 years or so. I was a 16-year-old on a farm in the hills of England. We'd only recently had electricity and running water installed. So it was you know, a little like the Dark Ages, you might say. We had paraffin lamps before that and no TV. So we were very blissfully unaware of what was going on in the world. But my father was concerned about that. And he thought that we were a bit too insulated from the world. You got to bear in mind that my mum and dad were professionals, she a nurse, and my dad a sea captain, out in the Far East. So they had a great time, professional life out there. And then when they decided to give that up for a family life, they took up farming, of which neither of them were qualified for at all. And that so it was a hard life. And an isolated life. We went to a village school. The school didn't have running water. We used to have to go and fetch it from the well every day, every morning, and put chlorine tablets in it to purify it. So God knows what kind of well it came from, you know. And I mean, so it might have been the sewage well. But life was very countrified, isolated. And Dougal, my dad, wanted to broaden our horizons. And I don't know why he couldn't have just waited, like in your introduction, and sent us off to university. I don't know why he couldn't have done that instead. But he wanted to take us, allegedly, on a trip around the world for our education.
And your dad, as you mentioned, had sailing experience. What kind of training did he give the rest of you before you set sail?
Well, that's a good question. And I'm afraid the answer is absolutely none. I don't know how on earth he expected us to be able to sail this yacht. I mean, sailing a yacht, you know, it's not as easy as sailing a motorboat. You've got sails and halyards and winches and things to learn. And we were farmers, so we had to start from scratch. And we didn't learn before we set sail. We weren't treated to training courses. Dougal said, "You'll learn on the job." That was his statement. And as we were sailing from Falmouth in that January 1971, Dougal was seen to be stamping his feet, shouting yee-haw as we left the port. And we then got the first inkling that maybe this was not for our benefit at all, but was more his wish, you know.
Oh, man. The visuals of that are incredible. And when you set sail, it was your mom and your dad. You were 16, as you said. Your sister was 18, and the twins were 12 years old. So what role did everyone play in on the yacht?
Well, my sister had gone to Miami, to Malta, to fetch the yacht back to England to start the trip. So she did have some experience. And my dad had also done that. So he had, you know, like a month's experience on the yacht before, which is a lot more than we had. So they were gods compared to us. But we had been in Falmouth for maybe three months before we set sail. So we'd sort of got used to the boating life and, you know, the dinghy and the trip ashore and all that sort of stuff. And we were looking forward to tropical climes, and it was now winter, deep midwinter in England. January and February are the coldest months. And so my job was to run, fetch and carry, I suppose, because I didn't have any knowledge as such. I would be my father's right-hand man. My sister, and so therefore a watchkeeper. So I was a watchkeeper. My sister was a watchkeeper also, because she had some experience. Steering, you had no automatic steering. And then my mother looked after us. And the twins were too young, but they helped us with tasks that we carried out. Pumping the bilges, cleaning the boat, etc., those sort of things. I mean, they were there having a good time, really. But but the weather was initially didn't help that.
And the roles kind of shifted as the adventure continued, especially after you became shipwrecked, which we'll definitely get to in a second. But you talk about how there's a lot of really beautiful memories along the way before the wreck happened. Can you talk about what memories stand out to you in particular?
Yeah. I mean, it was fantastic, a fantastic trip for all the hardships that we had to endure aboard Lucette. The bad weather. You know, professional sailors don't care about the weather. So Dougal didn't care about the weather. We would set sail in the most ridiculous weather conditions and we just had to get on with it, you know. But we met an Icelandic family in Falmouth before we set sail. They were also sailing around the world, or they were going to try to, and they had a sea captain as well with his wife and children. Icelandic, so different nationality, but they spoke good English. And we decided we would sail together. We'd meet up in ports, different ports in the world, and we lined a similar track, if you like. So we'd go down to the Canaries, cross the Atlantic, sail up through the Caribbean, up to Miami, Florida, and then we would reassess what we were doing from Miami, Florida. Then we would go down south, Caribbean, Jamaica, to Panama, Ambulas Islands, cross the Pacific Ocean to Australia, New Zealand. Then we would think about how to get back home. The Suez Canal was closed still then. They were carrying yachts by low loader across alongside the Suez Canal. So that Suez Canal option was something that we were thinking about, rather than sailing around the Cape of Good Hope. So we had a voyage plan set out, and we hoped that the Icelanders would be able to stay with us. And it did go like that, largely. We sailed on the Bonny, so the Icelandic boat, so they sailed on our boat. And in Biqui, in the Caribbean, the island of Biqui, it was there that Siggy, the father of the and captain of the Bonny, gave us a life raft, saying it's better to have it and not need it than need it and not have it. And my dad didn't want it. He always said that the safest lifeboat was the boat we were already on. If we just stay on it, send an SOS, we'd get picked up. We'd get, you know, taking to a life raft would be certain very high risk maneuver, and it could never come to that in his mind. And I say, even now, I'm 69 years old, it's 51 years ago, and I say thank you to Dougal every day for taking us on that trip, because it was fantastic, mind-blowing experience in our lives, and it left us with images that we'll just never forget.
And thank you to Siggy for the lifeboat.
And thank you to Siggy. And just this year, just a month ago, we went to Iceland and visited his grave and said thank you to him for what he'd done, because he was a family man and he knew that Dougal was a bit of a risk taker. And, you know, he did blackmail my dad in the end. My dad said he didn't want it. And he said, I'm not giving it to you for you, Dougal. I'm giving it to you for your wife and children. Mm-hmm. So Dougal couldn't say no, you know.
When you were in the Galapagos, you witnessed a humpback whale and her calf. And in your book, you talk about this left a lasting impression on you. How so?
Well, we met a sea whale, S-E-I, baleen whale, big baleen whale, that tried to make love to the boat.
Oh.
Yeah?
Well, that would have left a lasting impression.
Yeah, that made a lasting impression, yeah. So the point about the sea whale trying to make love to the boat, it left a lasting impression because we thought we must look like a whale from underneath. And I mean, obviously it swam off. It didn't get what it was looking for and swam off. But it left that impression that we maybe looked like a whale from under the water.
Yes, which caused problems later. Yeah. And you all had foretelling dreams about the Lucette's fate. Do you remember having that dream?
Yeah, well, we were in a rough situation, in a perilous situation all the time at sea, because it's a small yacht and a big ocean, you know. And my mum especially had the idea that we weren't going to make it to the Marquesas, you know. And she did pack equipment and things ready for the trip across the Pacific, because she was, you know, we said that she was making a drama out of it. You've got to bear in mind my sister had left by then, and we had a student called Robin Williams with us, who joined us in Panama. But he was always very pragmatic, and he didn't really believe in what other people saw as visions and things like that. But we were seafarers, and they say that seafarers are very not suspicious, that they're very sort of humble people. Who, because they learn to be when you're sailing at sea all the time. And so I guess it was nothing more really than a sailor's natural superstitions, that especially before a long trip where we knew that we would be tested. You could argue it like that, but we certainly all had trepidation about the crossing. That was about a 42 day crossing.
That's a long time without not a lot of landmarks. Yeah. You mentioned that your sister was no longer with you at that point. Where did your sister end her trip with all of you?
She met somebody in Nassau in the Bahamas, and we went from there to Miami, and she left us in Miami to try and start a new life with him. The United States government would not allow them to get married, and they were under 21 and needed parental consent, and so that didn't happen. And the boyfriend Jeff went back to Nassau where he lived, and Anne followed him back to Nassau. So she either left us in America in Miami, or she left us in Nassau. We don't quite know where she left us. Physically, she left us in Bimini when we'd sailed out to Bimini to renew our visas.
So at that time, you had gained another traveler, because he was kind of hitchhiking, if you will, with your crew, and in a sense took your sister's spot.
Yeah.
Tell me about when the killer whales approached the boat.
So this was now the 15th of June, 1972, and we'd struck out for the Marquesas. As I said, it was a long voyage, and we were 200 miles west of Cape Espinosa in the Galapagos Islands. And I had just woken up. I'd been on the night watch, the 12 to 4 watch during the night. And my brother Sandy was at the wheel. And I saw a shape over on the starboard bow, quite a distance, maybe a quarter of a mile away, something like that. I knew it wasn't a bird. It was too solid. And we had caught a squid on the line overnight. And I remember saying to my brother Sandy that where there are squid, there's usually bigger fish because they hunt the squids, you know. And then they struck us. They hit us. Bang, 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 like that. Resounding, loud, cracking, shattering noise it was. And I thought we must have gone aground. We must have gone, you know, and then I was thinking, how can we go aground in the middle of the Pacific? And then three killer whales surfaced behind us. They were now following us. And one of them, its head was split open and blood was pouring into the water. And I immediately knew what had happened. They must have attacked us. I mean, wild animals don't make mistakes like that. They wouldn't just run into us. They would have attacked us. So we did look like a whale from underneath the water, but this time for a different reason. And the boat was going down, sinking very quickly.
All of you got the emergency raft and began to abandon ship, essentially, right?
Well, I poked my head down the hatch, informed my father, who was doing a morning sight, celestial navigation, to ask him, really, what's happened? There's this loud cracking noise, you know, and I noticed he was up to his ankles in water. And I thought, what's he doing? What's he doing? You know, and I looked over, I heard a noise, a swishing noise, looked over my shoulder, and there were the three killer whales. And then I looked back down to tell my dad there's whales, killer whales. Killer whales must have hit us. And he was up to his knees in water already. And I was thinking that whatever he's doing, that's serious. You know, I still hadn't realized we were sinking. And Dougal, visibly, in the time that I was talking to him, the water had come up to his waist. And he said, abandon ship. And being a petulant teenager, as I was then, I told him we couldn't possibly abandon ship because there was nowhere to abandon ship to. I said, where? Where are we going to abandon ship to, Dougal? And he said, over there, meaning out in the sea. And he said, launch the life raft. And I looked at him with absolute disbelief. I could not believe he was saying those words. And he said, go. And I sort of shook myself and went forward and launched the life raft. It's an 80-pound bag, basically, but I just picked it up and threw it over the side. The adrenaline was pumping. I pulled in the rope and the inflation rope, and to our lasting relief, the life raft started to inflate, and we knew if it would inflate, at least we might be able to get on it. And if we could get on it, we might survive. There was still the killer whales swimming around. And then the yacht had sort of sank below the waves by then, and I was washed off the foredeck. I did manage to get the dinghy and the oars over the side as well. And in the sinking, the dinghy filled with water and sank as well. But my dad had the presence of mind to tie it to the raft. And because it was full of water, it held the raft back so that we could actually get to it, because it was quite a strong wind. It's a 4-6 wind. And so it was 2 minutes of absolute mayhem, chaos. And we thought we were going to be eaten alive by these whales anyway, as when we got into the water. But they didn't. They didn't come after us. Maybe they went after the one that cut its head open. We don't know, but they left us alone. That was what's important. And we regrouped aboard the raft a few minutes later. We'd swam out towards, you know, chasing the raft down. And we then tried to assess what had happened to us and what we were going to do, you know, what would be the next step.
When you describe that, it's it sounds so straightforward, right? It sounds chaotic, but it sounds so straightforward. The ship was sailing. We got the life raft. It inflated. We got in the life raft. But in your book, you go through the details of the back and the forth and the decisions and the panic. And you really do such a good job of laying out what it felt like to be in that moment, trying to reconcile reality with, you know, what you had hoped was happening. And am I dreaming? Am I not dreaming? And I was surprised to read that you were actually the last person to get in the life raft. Is that correct?
Yeah. So when I got the raft over the side and pulled the inflation cord, what I didn't know was that the rafts have enough gas in them to inflate the raft in the Antarctic or the Arctic, in polar regions. We were in the tropics, so it had more gas than it needed. And it vents that gas off so as not to burst the raft. And I was trying to fix the leak what I perceived as a leak in the raft. So I was staying out there, and I was very, very frightened. I kept feeling for my legs to see if I still had them, because I'd heard that you don't feel the bite of a big animal. And eventually the gas expired, so it wasn't really an emergency at all. I just thought it was. And then I swam around the raft and got in, and I was surprised to see everybody there, all orange, very orange-coloured, because of the canopy of the raft. And everybody was looking. They were very happy to see me. My mum said later that she thought that they'd lost us in the sinking. It was very, very scary. The moment was very, very scary, those 2 minutes. And at the end of it, we'd lost our home. We'd lost our dream. And now we were faced with an impossible task and almost certain death. We didn't know how on earth we were going to get home, what we were going to do. We hadn't sent out an SOS. There hadn't been time. We had to think about ways that we might get home, you know, and we had to be brutally honest with each other. And I remember my mother saying to Dougal, tell us, Dougal, are we going to die here? Or do we have a chance? Do we have a working chance? And, you know, Dougal was faced with this huge decision about whether to lie to his family or to tell them the truth. And he felt that they deserved the truth. And he decided to tell us the truth.
And what did he say?
Dougal, first of all, had to lay a platform to tell us the truth. So he described what had happened. He said, well, we were 200 miles west of Cape Espinosa in the Galapagos. We've been hit by killer whales. We've got very little food and water. He said, we're 200 miles away from the Galapagos. He said, you know, that's not a long way. But was downwind and down current, I pointed out. You know, it would be very difficult to get back to Galapagos. And we were at 2,000 miles away from the Marquesas, which were downwind and down current. And the chances of hitting the Marquesas were negligible. So we probably had another 1,200 miles to go past there before we fetched up on the Indonesian, you know, the East Pacific coasts, if you like, the eastern countries of the Pacific. But it seemed to us that those were the only two options that were available. But as Dougal was laying that out, it occurred to him that maybe we did have a chance. He started the conversation with certain death. And by the time he'd described where we were and what had happened to us, ideas were coming to him about how we might survive. And as Einstein said, you know, you have to understand the problem to find the answer. And the problem would be lack of water, lack of mobility, lack of food, in that order. And so instead of delivering a very bad message to us, he found he was able to deliver a message of hope. And that we can survive, we can survive, but we have to learn how to do that. And I said to him, I looked at the frigate birds flying up above us, and I said, you know, they've got millions of years of development on their side, And as if to mock me, a flying fish jumped out of the sea, and this frigate bird swooped down and plucked it out of the air and flew off with it, you know. I thought, you know, that is taking the piss. And Dougal looked back and he said, well, Douglas, he said, we have tools and we have brains. And with brains and tools, we can bridge the gap. Those millions of years, we can bridge them. And we can catch our food. We can strike out a course for land. And we can survive.
Hey, Curiositors, just a quick pause to show gratitude to our sponsors and give you some special deals.
If you're new here, you may be surprised to know that the beautiful backdrop of my show is not a virtual screen. It's a real place that you can really rent inside of the Pensacola Museum of History. The exhibit space is called Trader John's. It's an old bar in Pensacola whose owner was just as eclectic as this town. And it's perfect for birthdays, work events, award ceremonies, retirement parties, family reunions. So don't pick another boring venue space for your next event. Give the Pensacola Historic Trust your business and make your event super memorable. Learn more at historicpensacola.org. The weather is cooling down here in the southern U.S., and that means it's fire ant season. For those of you not from the south, fire ants are about as pleasant as they sound, and their bites pus up into an itchy red mess that takes forever to heal. I recommend InSec for pest management because I've been using their mosquito service since 2019, and I love that their work is guaranteed. If you're in the Florida Panhandle or the Gulf Coast of Alabama, give InSec a call. It's ENSEC.net. Now back to the show. Remember to stay till the end where I give you a sneak peek of next week's episode. I loved how in this part of your journey, I felt like I witnessed you become a man, which is so strange of me to say to you in this moment. But when you're reading your book, you really see the contrast of you as a 16-year-old with no sailing experience to you as, at that time, 18, having watched your home sink to the depths of the ocean. And you're really saying with confidence, you're contributing with confidence, ideas and solutions to this problem. And I loved reading the contribution of everyone in this time, your mom especially. It just seemed so brilliant that she had this nursing background. And I for one, had no idea that enemas were a solution to dehydration. And she would administer to them to all of you, except for, I think, Robin, who declined. And he suffered a bit of dehydration because of that. Tell me more about what everyone contributed to the survival of all of you during that time.
Well, if I just wind back a little bit, that when you say I became a man, I do feel that because not only did I contribute with ideas, because I had some, and I must say they were more like blind ideas. My father was our leader and he would have to weigh up these sort of contributions. But Dougal did come up with a plan that I should row the dinghy back to the Galapagos Islands. Now, we called him Captain Bligh because he was a very, very assertive man. And it was then that I said to him, for the first time in my life, I said no to Dougal, that I would not do that. That was a fool's errand and that I thought we would all die if we split up. So... And I think that was the moment that I did become a man when I stood up to my father, you know, and sort of denied his request or his direct order, if you like. And Dougal did agree with me that it would have been a fool's errand and that it was the wrong decision. And it changed our relationship, if you like, in that moment of time. In that first few hours, we made an agreement with each other that we would not eat each other, no matter how hungry we got. That we would die together if we were going to die. And Dougal vowed he would not rest until he got us on a steamer home. He promised us that. And he also promised that he would never stop trying to get us to land, to find land and to sail to land. So we made a bargain, if you like, a bargain across generations that I think parents and children make all the time without realizing it, you know, in the world that we live in. But here we recast those bargains, if you like, those contracts between parents and children about what we would do. And with that out of the way, we then had to make a plan about how we were actually going to achieve that. My mum, of course, she was worried about the care for us. I mean, it's no good just being a leader and leading your people over the precipice. You know, you need to be able to take care of your people too. And this is what my mother's role was. It was as important as my dad's, but my dad led us to rescue, if that makes any sense. And then my mother picked up the pieces after that. She helped catch food. She helped cure the food. She helped preserve the food. She made sure that the twins had their little supplement every night. And she, at one point, we self-rationed the water. You know, Dougal said, take as much as you want, but only as much as you need. You know, just bear that in mind. And we would take a sip from this jar that we passed around. And my mother had stopped drinking water to preserve it for the others. And Dougal had to sort of play an ace on her and said, look, Linda, if you don't drink water, I'm not going to drink water either. And the twins cannot survive without us.
And the twins, I feel like they really kept everyone honest, as you say, to stay motivated for the end goal of making it out of there. Tell me about what you ate, how you caught wildlife once your rations ran out.
We came up with ingenious ways of catching wild animals. You don't stand a chance of catching them in this everyday world. But the very first fish that we caught jumped on board the raft. So you know, it made it, and we grabbed it and killed it. And I had read in a book, I didn't tell my father it was a fiction book, a novel. I didn't tell him that at the time. I just said I'd read in a book, Dougal, that you can actually eat turtles. So we decided to catch a turtle and see if we could eat it. And it took us a while to catch one. The first one came to us and I hit it over the head with a piece of the paddle. And blood came into its eyes and it swam off. And I thought, well, what's the point of swimming off? You're going to die anyway. And then I realized that actually you have to hunt. There's a difference between catching and hunting, you know. You had to hunt these animals. They wanted their life, even if they were only going to live another 10 minutes. They wanted that 10 minutes, you know. And if they got away, then we couldn't eat them. So the next one I managed to catch and I thought, I'm not going to let it swim away. So I picked it out of the water and passed it into the raft. And of course, this turtle's now pecking and waving its flippers. And Dougal picked it up in case it damaged the raft and threw it out through the front of the raft and off it went, you know. And we were thinking, well, we're not going to get very far like this. You know, we have a much more serious attempt. And the third one, I managed to wrap it in rope so it couldn't get away. And then we corralled it round to the dinghy. We had the dinghy towing the raft and we cut its throat and drank its blood. So just like it said in the book, you could drink the blood of the turtle. But as I say, I never ever told my dad it was a fiction book.
Oh, I love that. The behind the scenes. Yeah. Now come day 38, you were finally rescued. Tell me how that came about and what that felt like.
Well, it was on the late afternoon, 4 o'clock-ish of the 38th day. And we had made a lot of progress. We'd sailed 750 miles in that dinghy and we were headed towards America. We'd found out ways of determining our position. We had a good idea where we were. I was going to start rowing that very night, rowing full time during the night to get, we knew we were about 10 days off the American coast. In actual fact, we were only 6 days off the American coast. We were a lot closer than we thought, but with the right way, you know. And suddenly a shape appeared on the horizon. And Dougal looked at it. And you can bear in mind the horizon's only about 3 miles away when you're on a little raft like that. And he looked across and he said, "There's a ship over there." And I said, "Dougal, you just said there's a ship over there." Bearing in mind the ship had sailed right past us on the sixth day. He said, "Yes, a ship. Bloody hell, there's a ship, you know. This is it. It's rescue that we want as well as survival. We had so got it into our mind that we weren't going to be rescued and that we were going to have to sail all the way to the American coast that we'd forgotten that we might get picked up on the way. We cleared the decks and we were full of trepidation in case this boat sailed past us. We didn't want to be left behind a second time." And Dougal fired two hand flares. And the last flare was burning his hand so much, and he threw it away into the seaway. And that was the bit the Japanese saw. It was a Japanese fishing boat. And it saw just that flare, that flash of the flare going into the sea. And they altered course, thinking, well, they could see a little shape, but they couldn't see any people in it. And they thought, well, we'll go over and have a look at that. "Are you sure you saw a flare, yeah? A flare. Oh, yes, I saw a flare." And they altered course, and we saw them alter course, but not towards us. And we thought, they haven't seen us. It's like, you can't believe it. You know, you can't believe you're about to be rescued. You just don't let yourself believe that. Anyway, she then altered course another 20 degrees, and we thought, well, she must have seen us. They're coming over to pick us up. And suddenly they were upon us, looking at us incredulously. They couldn't believe their own eye. I mean, we couldn't believe seeing them, and they certainly couldn't believe they were seeing us. And they actually asked us if we wanted to come on board, you know. And they threw this rope across, this dirty, oily rope, and I grabbed hold of it and held it in my hand. And I thought, this rope belongs to a world that we are no longer part of, but we are now going to rejoin it. And I pulled the rope in, and it was such an overwhelming feeling. You know, I mean, somebody's given you your life back.
Yeah.
You can't thank them enough. You know, we said, "Thank you, thank you, thank you." And they're going, "Shut up. You have to keep saying thank you." we don't feel grateful. You know, it's all right. And they gave us a cup of coffee. And I remember the last time we tried to have a cup of coffee was when the whales hit us. There was a percolator on the stove. The aroma of coffee was going through the yacht. And we never got to drink that coffee. But when we did drink a cup of coffee, it was 38 days later after we'd survived this trip across the Pacific, you know, back across the Pacific. And of course, we were very grateful to our Japanese friends who we lost contact with. We never spoke to them again after that for rescuing us and delivering us back to Panama City.
A big upgrade from Turtle Blood.
Yes.
Well, you talked about rejoining society. I wanted to ask you about that. What was that like for you as an 18-year-old young man re-entering society and seeing your peers bothered and perhaps complaining about things that were pretty trivial compared to what you had just experienced?
Yeah. Well, it changes you forever. You know, you can't be bothered with the trivial. You tend to look at bigger pictures. I was talking to my your brother Neil just yesterday about this raft, and he was complaining about how it was still affecting him, and he was still dreaming about things that happened. And we're talking 50 years later, you know, and we didn't often talk about it. Neil doesn't like to talk about the raft very much, but we were talking about it. And they're going to make another film out of the story. And I was discussing about the contract arrangements to produce this film. And he was telling me how he's still affected by it. So I sort of sensed that I'd sort of gotten over it after 20 years, you know. I'd stopped dreaming about the sea and about the Lucette and about the sinking of the Lucette. And the privations that we'd suffered on the raft during that time. And my sister says that it made us fearless, that we don't understand fear properly. And that might be true because maybe we take too many risks with things. Although I don't see myself as a risk taker. I'm an accountant, for Christ's sake. You know, accountants don't take risks with anything. But probably I am in the world of accountants, quite a risky chap. You know what I mean? As seen by other accountants, you know? So maybe we are risk takers. Maybe we don't perceive risk like other people do. And my sister says, again, God bless my sister. She says, Douglas, you've had seven lives. Seven things have happened to you in your life that what a person would expect to deal with once in their life. Having those experiences and being able to deal with those experiences, I believe, came from this experience on the raft.
Aside from changing your threshold of risk-taking, as we wrap up, how else do you think that experience prepared you for life on land?
Well, I'm always willing to have a go. I have great hope in my heart. And if you want an adventure, do something with Douglas, you know, because I'm not really quite, I don't see in straight lines, you know what I mean? And so in that way, but that could have been the trip on the Lucette that made me like that, you know what I mean? And we're never quite sure, but certainly they never give up. Never give up because you never know how this is going to turn out. That is the message that I pass forward. When you are faced with a dilemma, do not give up. Always look for a solution. There is one there somewhere. Find that solution and believe in that solution, and you will have success. That's my message from my experience on the raft.
That's an incredible message, and the book is incredible. I enjoyed it so thoroughly. It's so easy. I recommend everyone get it, by the way. But
thank you.
Keep in mind, I want to tell the dear listener that you're reading a real person's story because it's so well written and so unbelievable. So many twists and turns, and you think like, oh, this is when they're going to get rescued, and then something else happens, and then we didn't even talk about how your life raft gave out on you, and you had to abort that and get onto a 9-foot dinghy with all six of you. We didn't even, you know, there's so much here, but just remember that it's a real person's story. So as we close, tell people where they can find you and buy your book. If you can share anything about the film, share that too.
Well, it's on Amazon, obviously, the book. You know, you can order the book from there. There are secondhand copies as well available that for very little money. Some of them even signed, you know, so you can get a signed copy from there. There are two books. There's a book by my father called Survive the Savage Sea, and then my book called Last Voyage of the Lucette. My book is about the trip on the Lucette, as well as the sinking of the boat and the voyage on the Edna Mare, the life raft. Dougal's book is more a chronology of events, so it's a little bit harder to read, but it is sort of the source, if you like, the source of the information. And I use my dad's book to help me write Last Voyage of the Lucette, for instance, you know. But people say that reading Last Voyage of the Lucette is a lot more entertaining than reading Survive the Savage Sea. And I hope it is the case. There's already been a film made of Survive the Savage Sea and called Survive the Savage Sea. That's my father's book. And there's been a National Geographic film made of my book called Last Voyage of the Lucette. We are just about to enter into a contract to make another film on the Last Voyage of the Lucette. Given modern technology and things like that, it should be a lot more entertaining than previous versions.
Also, and hopefully the family will be British too, because I started to watch the 1992 film and I was like, they didn't go to Australia. It's not how that happened. Yeah. Like I couldn't watch it because I just read your book. So I was annoyed the whole time and shut it off.
Well, I've got to say, this book, as you just said there, is a real story from a real survivor of a real shipwreck. And, you know, nobody knows a story like that or how to tell a story like that other than somebody who's been through it. And I've heard lots of TV survival experts and people like that. They've all got solutions about how you would survive. None of them that would really work because they haven't actually had to survive, you know, go through a situation where your life is at risk. all of the time. It affects your thinking, you know, it affects your ability to make decisions. And you do not have the hope or the stamina that you would have, the stamina to find a decision, the energy to find a decision, if your life isn't truly in danger. You know, you have a total new energy that comes to play. And so there's essentially going to be of The Last Voyage of the Lucette, which is my book, the new film. And who knows? Why has the story lasted for so long? Because I think it's about parents saving their children rather than people saving themselves. And we all save our children. We all try to save our children in this world. But this is just an extreme version of that, if you like, where my mum and dad had to save us from a very life-threatening situation.
Absolutely. Well, I'm glad that you made it. I'm glad that you are sharing your story with the world. And I'm so glad you decided to share it with us today. Thank you. This was fantastic.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to share it.
Thanks for listening. If you liked this episode, you'll also like the one I did with a former meth addict who used to live in the underground tunnels of Las Vegas. It's episode 138. And you know, they say word of mouth is still the best way for a podcast to grow. So, since you made it this far, now's a great time to take a screenshot and share about it on social media. Be sure to tag me. I'm at Meredith For Real. Stay tuned next week when I talk with a woman who turned a public Starbucks meltdown into what she calls a careergasm.